Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
This week, our critics Christy Lemire and Lael Lowenstein review Kajillionaire. It's a comedic drama from writer-director Miranda July. It stars Evan Rachel Wood, Richard Jenkins, and Gina Rodriguez. Misbehavior, a British drama starring Keira Knightley and Gugu Mbatha-Raw. It's based on the true story of the first black woman to win the Miss World contest. Plus, we'll talk to some of the cast and crew behind the upcoming drama Nomadland. It's a film festival darling based on journalist Jessica Bruder's acclaimed book about older American workers who are houseless, not homeless, thanks to the Great Recession, traveling the country looking for work. It's all just ahead on Film Week, right here on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Coming up later on the show, we're going to hear from some of the people behind the new film Nomadland, including its star, Frances McDormand, plus my interview with writer-director Miranda July, whose new movie Kajillionaire, starring Evan Rachel Wood, is out this week. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Lael Lowenstein, film critic for KPCC and film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Christy Lemire, film critic for KPCC and RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. A quick housekeeping note before we get started. There are some films this week that are screening at indoor theaters that have reopened in Orange County. We are not suggesting or endorsing that anyone go see a film at an indoor theater, but anyone who decides to do so should consult COVID-19 protocols from the CDC, your local public health agency, and the theater where you're going to see the film. Now, on to the reviews. We're going to start with Kajillionaire. It's a comedic drama about a family of small-time con artists who are trying to get by in L.A. It stars Evan Rachel Wood, Deborah Winger, Gina Rodriguez, and Richard Jenkins. Miranda July directs and wrote the screenplay. Christy, why don't you get us going?
This is just a wonderfully surreal and strange and singular and ultimately sweet story. It's a very L.A. story, although it's simultaneously rooted in a realistic LA, but it's also just this weirdo, far out, dreamlike version of LA as well. And that's the beauty of Miranda July, is that she can function on both of those levels so beautifully at once. So Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger and Evan Rachel Wood play this family of con artists. They are barely getting by. They are like living day by day. They live in like a bizarre office building with cubicles where it fills up with pink soap bubbles every day in the afternoon at the same time. It's just an odd place. And then on one of their many scams, they come across Gina Rodriguez, who is like ready to jump in and join them. This is the only like little contrivance here that maybe is not quite right, but she's such a delight that you're happy to have her join in the gig here. So Gina Rodriguez joins in and becomes part of their little family of scam artists. And her introduction into their dynamic, which has been going on for like a quarter of a century now, shakes everything up for everybody and forces them all to reevaluate their relationship, but especially Evan Rachel Wood. And there's such delightful and odd and like delicate sweetness to the friendship that develops between Evan Rachel Wood and Gina Rodriguez. Because what Evan Rachel Wood is doing here, she's so withdrawn. She's so introverted and so awkward. And the voice she's doing is this deep, weird register. And everything about her is just kind of awkward and off. And Gina Rodriguez is just sunshine personified. And that, the way they change each other is so cool. So it's a really, really weird movie, but also ultimately a really sweet and human one.
Leo?
Well said, Christy. It's also very much a Miranda July movie. And to me, what that means, thinking really back to me and you and everyone we know, is that it centers on these incredibly quirky, idiosyncratic characters who don't adhere to any sort of social norms, really, or paradigms that you could possibly expect. And to that end, it does that extremely well. You cannot apply sort of ordinary logic to a Miranda July movie, or you will be immensely frustrated. But it is funny. It's weird. Like Christy said, this is about very, very low-level grifters so low that they, you know, their regular scam is to rob adjacent post boxes at the post office when they know that the mail person is not watching the box. So, you know, it's that low level. And so their scams are weird and not entirely largely remunerative, but they're creative and they're odd. And so, you know, yes, like Christy said, this evolving relationship between Evan Rachel Wood, who's this child, you know, who never felt nurtured, and Gina Rodriguez, who is just sunshine, really kind of makes the picture. And it's weird. It's funny. It's definitely way, way offbeat and off the beaten path.
And I think years from now, it would make a great double bill with Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. It's also really well made. There's a scene where the family goes to visit somebody who is old and dying. And it is about a 5-minute scene, and it's one of the best scenes of any movie this year. Kajillionaire stars Evan Rachel Wood. It's in wide release, playing in Orange County theaters. You can also watch the film at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair, the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and the Rubidoux Drive-In in Riverside. Later on in the hour, stay tuned for my interview with writer and director Miranda July. Up next is the Netflix drama Enola Holmes. It stars Miley Bobby Brown of Stranger Things fame, with Henry Cavill and Sam Claflin. Helena Bonham Carter also stars. The film is rated PG-13, and it's the feature directing debut for Harry Bradbeer. Leo, why don't you get us started?
Sure. So Enola Holmes, played by Millie Bobby Brown, is the teen sister of Sherlock Holmes, and you know the lesser known of the Holmes siblings, we'll say. And she points out very early on that her name Enola spells backwards alone. And that is essentially where she finds herself in life. Her mother, played by Helena Bonham Carter, is missing, and she needs to find her. In that mission, she drafts her brothers, and she goes on this incredibly kind of labyrinthine, clever and funny journey. It's very difficult. Millie Bobby Brown is so perfectly cast here, and she uses her wits and her cleverness to decode and solve the mystery of where her mother is. There's a few bits of it that I didn't care for as much. Like there were some shifts that I thought could have been maybe better and more thoroughly explained, but really gorgeous cinematography, really well acted, and you know, pretty entertaining all around. Nice to see the Distaff Holmes for once.
Christy?
So if you watch Stranger Things, you know what Millie Bobby Brown can do, and you know that she's had this like poise and presence beyond her years for many years now, but there's such a darkness and such responsibility on her shoulders on that show. And here, all that presence exists, but she is just a delight. I mean, she gets to be joyful and she is radiant and effervescent and has incredible comic timing. One thing about Stranger Things, she does not get to be funny. And here she absolutely does. It's a really hyperverbal performance. It's a lot of fourth wall breaking and talking directly to the camera. Harry Bradbeer, who directed it, did most of the episodes of Fleabag. And so it very much has that same kind of structure where she's making really self-aware asides to the camera. And from the very beginning, you're just hooked. Yeah, she is a delight. Henry Cavill as like the hunkiest Sherlock Holmes ever. I don't know how he finds time to go to the gym between solving crimes, but he does. And then Helena Bonham Carter is really perfect casting as Millie Bobby Brown's mom. They look quite a bit alike. They both got sort of an unconventional presence about them. She's the coolest homeschool mom ever. She's great inspiration for all of us who are stuck at home trying to teach our kids because they play like archery and tennis indoors. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a little overlong. It's based on a young adult novel by Nancy Springer. It's a little overlong at just over 2 hours, and it gets kind of weirdly violent toward the end in a way that's sort of jarring from the whimsical family-friendly adventure we've seen beforehand. But it's a lot of fun, so definitely a good thing to watch with your older kids at home.
Enola Holmes is the name of the film. It stars Millie Bobby Brown, Henry Cavill, and Sam Claflin. It's the feature directing debut for Harry Bradbeer. The film is rated PG-13, and you can see it on Netflix. Now, the British comedic drama Misbehavior, based on the true story of the 1970 Miss World pageant. It stars Keira Knightley, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and Jesse Buckley. The film is directed by Philippa Lorthop. Christy, why don't you get us going?
I had no idea this had happened. This is a true story. This is what happened at the 1970 Miss World pageant in London. And it's about how a group of women who were part of the women's rights movement going on then plot this elaborate yet rough-hewn plan to disrupt the pageant because they feel like it stands for just the objectification of women, that it keeps them in a certain place where, you know, men are still dominant and just icky in their lascivious praise of them. I mean, the way that the announcer describes these pageant contestants made me just cringe. It's just so, it's so sexist and it's so archaic. But, you know, back then, this was very family-friendly entertainment. And so from little kids to grandparents, you could sit in front of the TV together and watch the Miss World pageant. So in this particular year, a group of activists led by Keira Knightley and Jesse Buckley. Jesse Buckley is amazing, by the way. She can just do everything. And she's got this incredible naturalism and this accessibility about her. They are part of a group that plots to sabotage the pageant. And it's kind of like Miss Congeniality meets Mrs. America, because you have, you know, the very staid traditional pageant world, but also the rush and the thrill and the energy of the women's rights movement. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's a very traditional kind of feel-good British comedy. That's a really specific subgenre where it's based on a true story, but it's lighthearted and it's not going to really dig too deep and push too hard, but it's going to make a statement in a way that's lovely and warm and cozy. This is that. Greg Kinnear is very good as Bob Hope, totally skeevy, lascivious Bob Hope in this. So I enjoyed it.
Leo?
Yeah, everything that Christy said. This is also a nice film to watch with some maybe older children. I watched it with, I can't call them children, a couple of 18-year-old young women, and we all thoroughly enjoyed it. Like Christy, I knew nothing of this historical event, and I don't know if like Christy, but I grew up watching pageants and, you know, loving them. From this perspective, you know, now in 2020, it's quite a different thing. To look both at the sort of hideousness of the beauty pageants and what they represent, and also to see kind of the real kind of feminist breakthrough of these women at this time as depicted in this film. I want to give a shout out to Keira Knightley, who is, you know, I don't think I've ever seen her so good, so sort of just brazen and you know, unfettered in her expression. And Jesse Buckley also was absolutely terrific. I also really enjoyed Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who played Miss Grenada, just really wonderful performances all around. Greg Kinnear, Leslie Manville as Bob Hope's wife. And yes, there was an incredible amount of lasciviousness in the comments that were made both by the original host of the pageant. And I don't actually know if this is something Bob Hope said, but it precipitates one of the final revolts at the end of the film, where he's reading from cue cards. He's talking about, you know, women's feelings and women's rights, because it's news at this point that the event is being criticized by these ruffian women. And he says, you know, women's feelings, I care about women's feelings. Yeah, I want to feel women all the time. And that's when the women kind of lose it. It's this trigger moment. And, you know, it's really, you know, again, seen from this perspective today, it's really, it just really hits home. At the same time, and this is not to contradict the message of the film, the costumes are amazing. And, you know, watching it with these young women, we were saying, wow, I really love the costumes. I also like the message. Is it okay to feel that way? You know, to feel, is that contradictory to like both? And we decided it is okay. And it's really a quite a worthwhile film. I hope that people take a look at it.
Misbehavior is unrated. It's available to rent and buy on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Prime Video, and more. Next, and quickly, you have 30 seconds for this one. The Artist's Wife is the drama by director Tom Dolby. He co-wrote the film with Abdi Nazimian and Nicole Brending. It's rated R and stars Lena Olin and Bruce Dern. Lael, why don't you go in 30?
Okay, this was a really beautiful portrait of a relationship about a narcissistic abstract expressionist played by Bruce Dern, who is suffering from Alzheimer's and has to have a reunion with his adult daughter. And it was really predictable, but beautifully acted. And I thought really quite moving.
Christy, very quickly.
Beautifully acted. Lena Olin has such grace and such dignity and gets to wear amazing sweaters. It's predictable. It reminded me of that film, The Wife, with Glenn Close from about a year ago. Lovely acting, but that's about it.
Artist's Wife is rated R. It's available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. More reviews are just ahead on Film Week. We'll hear about the documentary Push about skyrocketing housing prices and the cost of urban living, the drama Inez, Doug and Kira, from first-time director Julia Knotts, back in just a minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle, and we're joined by our Film Week critics, Lael Lowenstein, film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. We continue our reviews this week with The Disrupted. It's a documentary directed by Sarah Colt and Josh Gleason. The film follows three different people trying to make a living and find their place in the U.S. economy. Christy?
It's a totally depressing but really necessary and really eye-opening film about just people being left behind in our current economy, in our evolving economy. You have a farmer in Kansas who's in his early 60s, who's had this land and his family for generations, but he's in massive debt and he has health problems and he doesn't know what to do about that. Do you pass it on to your sons? Do you sell it and try to pay off the debt? So he's in a place of real flux. There's a gentleman who's maybe in his 40s who has lost his job at a 3M factory in Northern Ohio when it shuts down. And he is trying to start over again and maybe wants to get a job working in HVAC. He doesn't want to work for anybody anymore, but he's got debt and he's got kids and grandkids. And then you have a woman in Tampa, Florida, who is an Uber driver. And she had been in the brokerage business, but then that all fell apart with the economic collapse of 2008. And so you've got these three people in very different industries, all of which are, you know, theoretically the quote unquote forgotten men and women that Trump campaigned on. And in the ensuing years, not only have their lives not gotten better, they've gotten significantly worse, and they are struggling financially and emotionally and physically. And they don't really ever say the name Trump. You see him in a TV clip briefly, but that presence is unmistakable, the undercurrent of, you know, within the malaise that they are all experiencing. And so it's how they struggle to survive and how they try to find answers and try to reinvent themselves when they're, you know, later in life and later in their careers. And I'm sure that a lot of folks watching it all over the country will see themselves in it.
It's worth seeing. It sounds a lot like a film I'm going to talk about later in the show, Nomadland, that doesn't come out till later in the year, about displacement. Disrupted is available to watch on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The documentary is written and directed by Sarah Colt and Josh Gleason, and it is unrated. Now, the drama Inez and Doug and Kira. It's directed by Julia Knotts, who makes her feature directing debut. Christy, why don't you start with this one?
Gosh, okay, this is hard to explain without giving stuff away. I'm going to try real hard. So it jumps back and forth in time. It begins at a funeral, and it's a man and a woman, and it's Doug and Kira at this point who are engaged to each other. Kira's twin sister Inez, her sororal twin sister Inez, has killed herself. And that inspires Doug, who had a intertwined and kind of codependent relationship with Inez, to go back and try to figure out what happened. She left no note. And Doug and Kira, in their own ways, revisit their relationship with Inez and with each other. Doug and Inez met in AA, and so addiction and codependency is a big theme here. It's really beautifully acted. I love all three performances. I really love Michael Chernus in this because he's not in any way a traditional leading man, either in his looks or in his demeanor, but he's got impeccable technique and so subtle here, the way he navigates all the emotions that he is called upon to show. Yeah, I really like this movie. It's edited very well because it's jumping around in time, but never in a way that's confusing or alienating. It's all momentum, forward momentum in telling the story.
Leo?
That's a good point, Christy. I think that kind of elliptical editing could have been really annoying. And often, you know, when reviewing a film, if it privileges like editing for the sake of being experimental, if it's a narrative film, it can be really irritating. But in this film, it worked really well. That is also true of the performances and Julia Kotz's directing, which I think really creates a sort of unifying undercurrent and sort of beautifully puts together this film, making it look kind of more almost lush than it was. It was, I think, shot on pretty much a shoestring. You can tell that because they're very, very limited locations. And it's a very tight little story, but it's quite hypnotic and really hooks you in, and you're sort of trying to figure it out the whole time. So I thought it was really pretty good.
Inez and Doug and Kira is the film. It's from director Julia Knotts. It's unrated, and you can catch it on video on demand platforms, including iTunes and Vudu. We continue our reviews this week with Push. It's a documentary directed by Frederick Gerton, which explores why housing prices have skyrocketed around the world and why urban living is so expensive. Christy.
Like The Disrupted, also a total bummer. However, very enlightening as well, and it shines a light on what is happening in major cities all over the world where, like, mom and pop stores and longtime local businesses and just apartments where families have lived for generations, everyone's getting pushed out. And the way it's shot and from the opening titles, it really grabs you. It's very innovative in the visual context in which it puts all these stories. And so the filmmaker follows this woman, Leilani Farha, who is a journalist, and she also works with like UN human rights stuff. From like Barcelona to London to Berlin, and then in New York City as well, cities all over the world where it's just impossible to live affordably. And so what's happening is like giant corporations are coming in and just buying up huge city blocks of apartments and then maybe just letting them sit there empty, either pushing the people out who live there outright, evicting them, or raising the rent to an extent that they couldn't possibly afford to live there. And then it's like a future that they're just betting on, right? And they don't care if it actually creates community. It's destroying communities. And so the film is about this trend and how cynical that is and how sad that is. And it's really eye-opening. I had no idea that was happening, but it is indeed. And I don't really know what to do about it.
And then it's not happening in places like Silicon Valley or resort cities like Aspen. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, huge major cities all over the world. London, Barcelona, Berlin, Stockholm, Seoul, South Korea, and also New York. Yeah.
The documentary is called Push. It's directed by Frederick Girton. The film is unrated, and you can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Now, Ottolenghi and the Cakes of Versailles. It's a documentary, maybe not as depressing as the one we've talked about already. It's from director Laura Gabbert, and it follows celebrity chef Yotam Ottolenghi as he assembles a team of the world's most innovative pastry chefs to put on a Versailles-themed culinary gala at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Lael, I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. What can you tell us about the movie?
Well, first, let me a little disclaimer, because as I was watching the film, which is quite sumptuous visually and has some of the most amazing decadent food you could even imagine, John, I thought, wow, could there be any more inappropriate escapism at this time when we've got so much going on in our world and so much social unrest and we've got COVID and we've got, you know, systemic racism and, you know, it felt wrong a little bit to be watching
a little too much. Let them eat cake.
Well, a little bit, which, by the way, apparently, according to this film, was an apocryphal statement. And I looked it up. So this must be the fact. Marie Antoinette allegedly really did not say let them eat cake. She was, you know, misquoted and that statement was applied to her. But certainly it has become associated with her. What I found fascinating about this doc, aside from the fact that I love most food movies, and there's a whole extensive list of them that, you know, one should see, this was a really interesting portrait of Ottolenghi, who is an Israeli English chef who has brought a kind of structure and rigor to the gastronomy. And also it's a really in-depth portrait of these five pastry chefs that he hires to assemble this event. So this was for the history of Versailles at the Met a few years ago. It also could not seem more inappropriate now to be looking at all these people gathering in an enclosed space, you know, but this incredibly opulent, decadent food. And also to hear each of these sous chefs, these pastry chefs, talk about the philosophy behind how they prepare their pastry. And there's some of them studied architecture, some of them studied dance. Most of them had some kind of a career before they became a chef. And, you know, the discussion about what went into this and the cultural history, the philosophy, the thinking about, you know, how Versailles was, certainly the gardens of Versailles were really about man kind of mastering nature, like creating this really structured and rigorous and exacting kind of space, and how that all started to crumble at the end, right before right around the time of the French Revolution. It was really, really fascinating and absolutely a feast for the eyes and made me mouth-wateringly hungry. And, you know, it's certainly beautiful to see and reminds me of a bygone time. I also love Laura Gabbert, the director. She did a film called Sunset Story a few years ago that I liked very much. So this was a much more penetrating than I expected it to be. Really quite a good doc.
And I think it is fair to say that Marie Antoinette did not say let them eat cake. She would have said gâteau because she was speaking in French. So we have that corrected now. The film is called Ottolenghi and the Cakes of Versailles. The film is directed by Laura Gabbert and can be seen on video on demand and at select theaters. You can check your local listings. LX2048 or 2048 is a sci-fi drama. It's written and directed by Guy Mosha and it stars James Darcy and Delroy Lindo. Christy.
This is such a weird movie and it's so ambitious and it's trying to do so much. So I'm going to try to describe it to you. So it's the near future, but it doesn't feel all that far away because the beginning of it is James Darcy in like head to toe hazmat gear, driving his convertible across the 4th Street Bridge into downtown LA. And it's totally desolate. He's the only guy in his office. It's just all empty cubicles and an empty conference room. So it kind of feels eerily relevant. Like we are all this guy. It's a futuristic Los Angeles. But again, it's you can recognize it, but it's also a little off, kind of like Repo Man. It's got some Repo Man to it, but it's also got some Blade Runner to it because it's about clones and VR and bringing virtual people to life and the ethical quandaries around that. The sun has gotten so bright and so toxic that people can't go out in the daytime. They only go out at night. James Darcy, in the middle of that, is finding out that he has a serious health problem and wonders whether to allow his clone to take over his life. There's a lot going on here. And then Delroy Lindo is the guy with the technology who created all of this stuff. And he's got some amusing moments. I almost feel like this needs to be a whole series because it's really ambitious and really specific and really strange. But even in the space of like an hour and 45 minutes, it's like it's trying to get so much in. I really like James Darcy in this though because he eventually has to play two different versions of himself, which are definite and specific from each other, although he's the same guy and that's tough. So I enjoyed it, but I also feel like, man, there's a lot going on and maybe too much.
LX2048 is the film. It's written and directed by Guy Mosha. It's unrated and available to rent and buy on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Fandango Now, and Voodoo. Before we break, we wanted to take a moment to remember Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died at the age of 87 last week. This week, theaters and drive-ins across the country are screening two films that have given audiences a look into her legacy, and we wanted to revisit them on today's show in her memory. One of those is the 2018 documentary RBG. It's directed by Julie Cohen and Betsy West. Got an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary Feature. I guess quickly, Christy, why don't you start with your thoughts about this documentary?
It's so great. It's so affectionate and so warm and yet really allows all the facets of Ginsburg's personality to shine through. You know, the intellectual rigor and the brilliance and the sharp mind and the stealthy kind of way she had with a zinger, but also the fact that she loved opera and gossip and could be playful and really warm. So it captured the multitudes that she contained. It made me want to go to the gym because like at age 85, she's there with her little 3-pound weights working out with her trainer. And it's so necessary to watch this movie now if you have not already and just appreciate what she fought for and who she was.
And Lael, why don't you talk a little bit on The Basis of Sex, which is a narrative film starring Felicity Jones as the young Supreme Court Justice.
Yes, pretty good biopic. Really, the doc is much better, but this was written by Ginsburg's nephew, Daniel Stiefelman, and it's really an affectionate portrait of her, and it also just shows the sort of domestic side of her life and everything she went through to get to where she was. Quite a strong performance by Felicity Jones.
So check your local listings to look up On the Basis of Sex and RBG. More to come on Film Week. Just ahead, my interview with the folks behind the upcoming film Nomadland. It's based on a book about older Americans who set out across the country in vans, RVs, and whatever vehicle they can afford looking for jobs. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle this week. The film Nomadland isn't coming out until December, But already, it's been getting a lot of attention on the film festival circuit ahead of its release. It won the top prize at the Venice Film Festival, and more recently, it took home the coveted People's Choice Award at the Toronto International Film Festival. Why is that Toronto Audience Award important? Well, each film that has won the award over the last 8 years has gone on to get a Best Picture nomination at the Oscars. After a recent outdoors screening of the film at the Rose Bowl presented by the canceled Telluride Film Festival, I moderated a Q&A with writer-director Chloe Jaw, the film's star and producer Frances McDormand, and several of the real-life nomads who play versions of themselves in the film. I started by asking McDormand how she pictured this loosely fictionalized version of a true story becoming a feature film.
Not being a writer or a director, I couldn't imagine it, but I had seen the writer, so I knew she could. So it's always, what I've learned in my very short life as a producer is work with the right people.
What was the basis of your character beyond what Jessica gave you? What did you find on the road when you were meeting nomads? How did you come up with the Fern that you played?
Well, we talked. Chloe and I talked a lot about my own desire to live on the road. I told my husband when I was around 45, I told him, I don't know if I told you guys this, I told him that when I turned 65, I was going to change my name to Fern, start smoking Lucky Strikes, drinking Wild Turkey, and I'd hit the road in my RV. So I got to do that 4 years earlier in a kind of a way.
Chloe, when you set about trying to not only document their lives but honor them, you're taking a piece of nonfiction and making it a narrative film. What was your greatest concern about the stories that you're going to tell about these people, even if you had to make fictional changes to the lives that they were living?
Jessica did a great job to introduce these characters, these amazing people, to us in her book. And through Jessica, I was able to meet each of them and got to know them and heard a lot of their stories. And our challenge was, how do we incorporate their colorful stories into Fern's journey? And we choreographed Fern's journey in a way so that can come organically. And so that was the challenge and the reward as well at the same time.
And how did you go about persuading Amazon to let you film there? Because the book is even more critical of Amazon. They've changed their practices in a little bit. But to get into Amazon and to go back to visit Empire.
Shh. Well, I don't make films about politics. That's now, we can leave that to the politicians. I like to present you the reality of the lives people live, and I'd like you to take away what your interpretations. And Frank can talk a little bit about how we convinced Amazon.
We called and asked.
I think I got some of your packages and everything was broken.
Yeah, I'm not a very good packager. But you know, I think it's a lot, what I've learned from our friends is exactly what Fern says in the unemployment office. I need work, I like work.
Swanky, I want to ask you, I think you hadn't, none of you had seen the film before, is that right?
Right.
I'm glad you're still with us. but I want to ask you about that journey of revisiting your life through the film and then revisiting again and what you see on screen. It was very, I've seen the movie twice, I was sobbing like a baby through this movie. What is it like to share your story so openly with an audience?
Part of it was fun and some of it was really, really hard. The parts where I really was myself the most were easy, but the parts where they asked me to go beyond my comfort level and beyond what was really me were very, very difficult. And Chloe can verify that. They asked me to say things that just weren't in my nature, and I couldn't make them come out of my mouth.
Derek, I'm going to ask you about this community that we've talked about and about these random encounters that people have. They pop up in the movie, they pop up in Jessica's book. Can you talk a little bit more about how connected all these people are, even if they're thousands of miles apart at any moment, and then they run into each other again, and how they kind of are this family, even as diverse and as spread out as they might be?
Well, yeah, you know, even if you've never met someone before and they've got kind of the same dirt under their fingernails as you do yours, it kind of makes you family. You're bonded by that dirt that you kind of work through together. And then when you run into one, say like in Quartzsite, and you spend another year and a half apart, then you run right back into them. It's kind of like no time has passed, but at the same time, you've just got a year and a half of from Maine to California stories to tell each other. And so it's kind of just this constant flow of, like, you understand each other and you understand where each other have been. So time doesn't pass a whole lot, it seems like.
Francis, I'm going to ask you about what you learned about these people that the book couldn't tell you, that your script couldn't tell you, and spending time with non-professional actors and how that might have changed you as a performer in making this film.
It was a lesson in humility to be accepted by a group of people, to know that whatever currency I've earned as a actor didn't make any difference if I couldn't pull my rig. And if I didn't know how to take a dump in my 5-gallon bucket. And if I didn't know that I was going to have to say goodbye and wait until I saw him later. And I think that it's not unlike the film community in a way. We're a little bit of a circus and we part and come back together a lot. But it takes a lot of courage to commit to the life.
Well, my own personal perspective on the matter is that, you know, we kind of do come with the dust, go with the wind. And, you know, someone might walk by in a town or something and say something nasty or whatever, but that's just kind of a grin under the bill of my hat, knowing, you know, well, shoot, I'll be in Arizona tomorrow anyway. It doesn't really matter what the heck they just said to me. I'm kind of living exactly how I want to live. I mean, we've all got tough skin. We've seen it all. And, you know, of course, the bottom line is people can always love each other a little more.
Swanky, what about you?
Well, I was a single parent of two little kids, and they were grown up and gone before I hit the road, which was about 12 years ago. I have more resources and more happiness and joy in my life now and more love. I have felt more love from Francis and Chloe and the film crew than I felt from my own biological family. And I can never really show my gratitude for that. Yeah, no.
I think we should have cars at every screening going forward, including indoors. Francis, I'm going to give you the last question. As we're speaking, if you see it, there's ash falling on us from the fire not far from here. And obviously, that's the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's going on in the world right now. But I think even though this movie is at points difficult to watch, it feels so filled with joy. And the people that are in this movie are so optimistic about their lives and about their relationships. I'm wondering what you took away from spending time with them, even amidst so much darkness. Where did you see the light, and what light did you take with you from working on this movie with them?
Well, our world was still light when we all met. It's just since we've been apart that it got darker. So I think that it's a great document of a very specific time in our world. And these are our elders, these are our leaders, and the commitment that they make to living in the land, with the land, is something that we're all going to have to practice a lot more.
That was Francis McDormand, the star and producer of the new film Nomadland. You also heard from writer-director Chloe Jaw and two of the real-life nomads who play versions of themselves in the film, Charlene Swanky and Derek Andres. More to come on Film Week. Just ahead, my interview with actress, writer, and director Miranda July. Her new movie, Kajillionaire, is out this week. We're back.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back in a minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle this week. Earlier in the show, you heard our critics rave about the new drama, Cajillionaire. It's about a family of small-time con artists who are trying to get by in L.A. The film stars Evan Rachel Wood as Old Dolio. Her parents, played by Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger, have raised her to be a part of their low-rent criminal schemes. But their comfortable family dynamic starts to change when they invite an outsider, played by Gina Rodriguez, to take part in a heist. I started by asking Miranda July whether her idea from the start was to have the family be con artists.
It was, and that the ways of the family would be really strong and almost cult-like. But yes, that baggage claim scene where they, in order to do this sort of mini heist, they have to pretend to be strangers to not know each other. And there was something so haunting about that, like pretending to not know your parents in public. And then I had the idea, like, what if they really became strange, like, in that moment? What if there was something about what was happening in the story whereby they were suddenly unfamiliar to her? And that was, in a way, that was enough. Like, how you get there and where you go from there is a movie.
And Old Dolio, who's played by Evan Rachel Wood, and I suspect I'm not the first person to say this, really reminded me of a hostage. And it reminded me of J.C. Duggar, who was kidnapped at age 11. She was held for 18 years. So almost about the same age as Old Dolio in the story. And after she was rescued, she said this of how she survived: I adapted to survive my circumstances.
Don't we all? I mean, I guess that, you know, it's sort of I think you could describe childhood that way. Like, you adapt to survive your circumstances. They may not be that bad, but nonetheless, you adapt to survive them. And then one day, sooner or later, you step into the real world, or you just suddenly realize that our way is not the only way. And I mean, it was important to me to have Old Dolio in that moment really want to go home. Because I relate to that both longing for freedom and the second you get out there feeling very guilty and like something's wrong here. And of course, it's not wrong, it's just new, it's just unfamiliar.
This is obviously a work of fiction, and yet the little cons and thefts that the family conducts feel very real. Is that part of the research of putting this script together, that you had to figure out how a family might go about stealing other people's stuff?
I mean, it's a combination of like sort of a mindset I had in my 20s as like a young punk. I don't condone any of this, by the way, and it was a long time ago. And, you know, for the record, like past the statute.
Youthful indiscretion, we call it.
Yeah. But I will say, like, the luggage scam, yes, me and my friends did do that one. Like, that was in my mind. That'd been my mind for years.
Where you pretend that you've lost a bag and get the refund.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to ask you about a scene that really stood out for me, and I'm not going to describe it in great detail because I don't want to spoil it, but it's a scene where a family visits the home of a man who is not in good health. And it really seems to me to define the movie, this mix of grifting, kindness, playing characters that the family isn't, and then remembering pretty quickly, at least one character, that this is not a hospice visit, this is a heist. So I'm curious how that scene came together, because it seems so central to everything that happens in the film.
I mean, I've always had the idea that art, that pretending, that making things up is real, like can make real things happen, can make real transformation happen, even if its basis is make-believe. And they pretend to be a family. I think that's okay to say, not a spoiler of my own movie. And, you know, while it seems in the moment to old Dolio, maybe, that they will pretend into reality, that maybe they are all changing in that moment, that it doesn't exactly happen that way. But I always think of that as the moment when the movie itself changes, sort of the pivot where it does all become realer on an emotional level.
There is such a specific look to so much of this film, the way the characters dress, the way they walk, the place they live in. But I'm curious about how they speak, especially Evan Rachel Wood's character. She has a deep kind of husky voice that is so unusual for people who have heard her act before. Where does that come from, and how did you settle on that as the voice of this character?
I mean, full disclosure, I would not have asked an actor to do a voice, like, you know, like a limp is one thing, but a voice, that just seems dicey, you know? And once you start, what if you change your mind, you know, like, but Evan, during rehearsal, one day she was like, she sort of dropped her voice and she was like, you know, I can talk down here. This is my original register. And I was like, whoa, what? What are you? And she's like, yeah, I used to get vocal nodes. And so a vocal coach trained my voice up to here. And this is the voice people are most familiar with, but I'm equally comfortable down here. And I was like, hold on, wait, really? Like you could do this for a whole movie and that would feel okay. And it was no problem. And not only that, it was obvious that when she used that voice, she really dropped down into old Dolio. And it was kind of a way in for her. And it really fit. Like you could imagine, I mean, there's so many like queer women I've known who it's like, are they doing something consciously to lower their voice, or is that just their true soul? You know, I feel like it's a mutable territory anyways, and sort of fine if it, like you don't even have to know whether that is something she's doing or just who she is.
And my last question is kind of an art imitating art question. This is a story about a family trying to find something, find a home, find a way, find a path, find means. And yet this film started off at Annapurna, which is no longer really around. It was briefly going to be bought by A24. Then it was bought by Focus. And it's been, I think, 2 years since you shot it. Does it feel like in some ways the film is kind of on a parallel journey to the Dine family in terms of finding its way out?
Well, I mean, that's a nice story. I would just say there was a lot of interest at Sundance. We went to the company that was most passionate. And, you know, maybe we were waiting for the pandemic. Like, maybe this is a movie that is for us now. And we didn't need it badly enough before. And maybe it makes more sense now. I mean, the movie comes out this week. This is the life we're living now. And I've decided to own that. Like I think in some faded way, it was meant to play out like this. And this is the audience that will most respond to it, us now.
That is writer, director, and actress Miranda July. Her new movie, Kajillionaire, is out this week. Thanks so much for listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.